Scrubbing In with Becca Tilley and Tanya Rapp, an iHeartRadio podcast.
Hello, everybody. We're scrubbing in. It's a Thursday.
I actually have a clinical update.
Hit me.
So, ever since I turned 30, everybody's been telling me to like get my eggs checked, freeze your eggs. Everybody just likes to tell you what to do. And I never really looked into it or thought about it for a while. And then I recently realized, you know, it's not a bad idea to kind of just like take a look, see what's going on down there. Mm-hmm. So I made an appointment with this fertility specialist and had an appointment via FaceTime. The first one was via like FaceTime with the doctor. And he gave me like a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And then I went in and actually had them like count. They like put an ultrasound that you do an ultrasound. Mm-hmm. They like count the eggs in your ovaries and like examine things. Let me tell you, for anybody that has gone through the IVF experience, because that's basically what I was signing up for without signing up for it. It's like the initial, it's like the protocol that you do to start the IVF process.
Are you talking about to freeze your eggs?
Freeze your eggs or freeze embryos or either of those. It is such I can't even tell you what it did to me mentally, because I you know, I thought I was going to do it and I got great news. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of healthy, or they can't really tell you if it's healthy, but I have a lot of eggs and I have a good uterus and my lining is whatever way the good way is. I don't know if it's thick or thin. But I had a good report card, and yet there's something about somebody telling you, like, if you don't plan on having children within the next 3 years, mm-hmm. you should really do X, Y, Z. And then you start looking into it and it's injections and it's birth control and it's hormones and it's invasive. And I was like really mentally not in a good place after that appointment. It was really weird because I thought it was going to give me like peace of mind. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way it did, but it also, it just makes you feel a certain way. And I feel like I've heard so many women that have gone through the IVF process. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to share, if anybody's gone through that, that I have a sort of empathy and a sort of that I've never had before, because it really was a very weird mental space that it took me to.
Yeah, I think it's I think there's both feelings, because it's you got a good report card, you got good news, but then it's like also there's a time frame.
Yeah.
And so like you have, if you're gonna, you know, in this amount of time, this is when you should be thinking about it. And that is what's like, there's, it's weird, not comforting, man. News, because you can't slow down time. Like time is not in your control at all. So like to know that you're on a time limit for something that's so personal and like vulnerable is, I get where that's not comforting.
Yeah, it's weird, because I also think too, it's like, you know, when God put something in your heart, it was, you know, he's going to see it through. And so I kind of take control away from me, you know, because I feel like it's something that's meant for me and something that was put on my heart. So I feel like it's going to happen in a way that it's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. But when you come out of that appointment, it's such a weird, like I was in such a weird headspace, and like Red Star could not have been more comforting and loving. Mm-hmm. And like, was really just like, let's talk about this. And you know, like, mm-hmm. cause there's just like so many different things to think about, you know? And it was very heavy. And I just felt like, you know, a lot of people go through this process, and I haven't really heard many people in my life talk about it much. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was a weird day.
Yeah. And I do think I always had the mindset of like, if you have the desire and then God will fulfill that. But I don't think it always happens the way that like we expect it to, because if I were someone who had a belief in God and like had a relationship with God, and I had that desire and I was struggling to get pregnant or get, you know, have that experience the way I always imagined it to be, then I would feel like I had done something wrong, that like my desire wasn't enough for God to fulfill that promise, I guess. So yeah. I think it doesn't mean, sometimes I think life shifts and you shift with it. And I think there's so many ways to be a parent. There's so many ways to have a family and to have a baby. And if it is not happening for you the way that you expected it to, like, it's okay to be discouraged and not, you know, be sad about that, because I think a lot of people struggle with it and don't talk about that reality as much.
Yeah.
But I think the miracle of life is so mind-blowing, that our bodies are capable of doing that, and like through all different ages that we are so strong and able to do that. So, but I'm glad you got good news.
Thank you. Yeah.
I don't know if I don't know. I'm like sitting here going, should I do that? But I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea. I would normally like encourage you to, you know, knowledge is power and knowing is better than not. But I mean, I don't know. It really shook me up. I'm in a little bit of a mental pickle. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many ways of how technology has progressed. That's really cool. And that we are able to have so much more information than we've ever been able to have. And at the same time, it's sometimes one of those things where you almost wonder, is that better for our mental state? Like, is it better having all the options?
Right.
But it's amazing what they can do now with technology. It's incredible. But totally. Yeah, that's good. I do think that there is, as I'm getting towards my mid-30s and kind of indecisive of like kids, unfortunately, there's time frame that's moving forward while I'm indecisive.
You know what's interesting though? This doctor really put me at ease because everybody told me, you know, when you turn 30, your eggs go into half or whatever. And like, he made me feel as though I was young. He was like, you're 34, you're good. He's like, I'm sure I'm going to count this many on this side, this many on this side. If we're in that ballpark, like you're good. And made me feel a lot.
No, 30 is when things.
Yeah. Apparently it's like, so when you're in your 20s, you have this amount or whatever. And then I'm not a doctor, so don't quote me on this, but it was something like, if you're trying in your 20s, you're like 95% going to, you know, if you're healthy, all things mm-hmm. you know, considered, it only drops to like 85 to 90% when you're 30. It's when you turn 40 when there's like the big drop.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
We should have like a fertility specialist come on. That'd be interesting.
It is an interesting, I mean, I learned a lot in my first FaceTime with him. That it was just like freezing eggs versus freezing embryos and how that whole process works. It's very interesting. I don't know, would our listeners be interested in hearing that?
No, yeah, let us know if you'd be interested in hearing more about that.
Yeah.
We have a guest today, and I'm really excited about our interview and for y'all to listen to it. She's an author. Her name's Christine Carlson, and she's written so many books, but she has written a lot about grief and how to live life after losing someone. And I think it's one of those things where you don't, like, you can't write about something like that unless you've gone through it, and everyone has a different experience. But I'm really excited for y'all to hear our interview because she is amazing.
And the main topic is don't sweat the small stuff. And I am a person that sweats all the small stuff. So I think we have a lot to learn from her.
I know. I think everyone does. So yeah. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with that interview. So we have a very special guest on the podcast today. We have Christine Carlson joining us. She is an author and her movie is made into a Lifetime movie. So she is scrubbing in today, and please welcome Christine Carlson.
Hey, hi everyone. How are you?
Okay. So I find this to be a little bit serendipitous because so it's November and this is kind of the time of year where I start thinking about my vision board for 2022. So I'm like preparing for January and just kind of new dreams and things like that. And you happen to be something that's going to be on my 2022 vision board, which is a New York Times bestselling author.
Oh my gosh. What is your book going to be about? I can't wait to hear about it.
Thank you so much. You know, it's going to be about a lot. It's going to be about a lot of things, but mostly about hope.
All right. I'm big in that category.
Yeah. Wait, tell me. So how do you become a New York Times bestselling author? I feel like that's a lengthy answer, but.
Basically you just have to go out there and, you know, put your whole heart and soul into your book, be very raw and real, resonate with your tribe and hit the ground running and promote.
How does
let everyone know about it?
I mean, I feel like writing a book is one of the most vulnerable things you can do because it is like there is this vulnerability and rawness that you have to bring into writing a book because you're not visually seeing something. I mean, your story actually came to life in the form of a movie, but you know, for most people, you're reading the book, you're picturing it. So you have to almost reveal these details that maybe you've never even talked about with your friends and like just open yourself up. What is that process like, especially with your book?
Yeah, well, interestingly, I work with a partner, Deborah Evans, and we have a business called bookdoulas.com, and we actually help people write their books. And one of the things that we really teach people is how to write your story for not just, first of all, like writing is very healing. Mm-hmm. So if you write for yourself to heal yourself and you don't think about the fact that anybody's ever going to read it, almost like writing in your diary, it turns out to be something that is a stream of like total consciousness that's connected to your heart. And then you can go back and edit that work and, you know, change whatever you need to change to make it flow properly, to create a structure and so forth. But I find that I write, you find your best writing place, first of all. Like I tend to write for my bed. Mm-hmm. And so that's my best place. I write on Richard's side of the bed. That's my late husband, who was a really big time writer. I still say I'm an apprentice writer compared to the way he wrote in his lifetime. So, but you know, find your best writing place and your best writing time, and then you allow yourself to be in it fully. Mm-hmm. And I like to say a prayer, and my prayer is, divine light and love, play me as an instrument in your finely tuned orchestra of life.
I love
and
that.
And when I do that, I tend to like open up my consciousness, and it takes all the pressure off me. It says to my ego, bye-bye ego, it's not about you.
Yeah.
You know?
For people that are listening, can you explain kind of what benefit they'll get from reading Don't Sweat the Small Stuff? Because I want to really dig into that, because just that in itself, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, I need to ask you a lot of questions about that, but like, how do you do that?
Oh yeah. How do you not sweat the small stuff?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is like, it's really a life practice not to sweat the small stuff, and everyone, the reason why it was so popular is everyone sweats everything all the time. And, you know, as you grow up and you become a grown up, you're like, lots of small stuff comes up. Yeah. Then you have kids and you have even more small stuff that you're sweating. So I teach 5 principles of happiness. And these principles of happiness are woven throughout the whole Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book series. And there are 9 books in the series now that are really niche kind of books for different categories of people, but they all have one thing in common. And that is how not to let the little things take over what matters most to you. And they're just full of a lot of wisdom, but the principles are about understanding your thoughts and how powerful your thoughts are, understanding your moods, and how not to look at life the same. You know that life is different in a low mood versus a high mood. Mm-hmm. Understand your feelings, how your feelings are present, and you don't have to like positive think your way out of your feelings. Your feelings will just come and go like the weather, like clouds in the sky. Understand separate realities, meaning like even as close as the two of you are, I'm sure you've noticed at different times, you see your lives through different lenses. And so you're in your own separate reality, no matter who you are or how close you are, you're always seeing life through your own individual lens. And then the power of really living super presently.
Oh, that's the humdinger.
That's the humdinger.
As I'm talking about my vision board for 2022.
That's the moment to moment choice. It's not just a one-time choice. It's a practice. And practice living presently, it sounds really easy. Oh, I'm just going to live presently. But it really isn't. It's about training your mind to be where you are, not where you want to be or where you were, but right here, right now.
How do you do that?
It's called practice.
Again, like it's a practice. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different tools that you can put into play. Meditation is one. Gratitude practice, when you spend a moment tuning into your gratitude. I teach what I call the golden pause. And that's where I take you into a guided imagery where we tune into gratitude for just 3 minutes. So there's these, you know, just whenever you get into your breath, that's why yoga is so vastly popular. Whenever you're in your breath and you're really focused on your breath in your body, you're present. When you take that out into the world, and it's just a training, you know, it's to notice when you're not present, bring your attention back right to the center, the vertical place in you, which is right here, right now. And that's what it is. It's just a constant practice, and you get better and better and better at it. And, you know, I always say, like, there's one thing about grief, and that is that when you're really heartbroken, or like you're in labor with a baby, you're really present, or you're scaling a mountain and you're in danger, mm-hmm. or you're in a car accident. Have you ever noticed, like, when you're having an almost accident or an accident, things just slow completely mm-hmm. down? It's because you've gotten really, really present. And that's how time is. Time is much slower in the present moment. And let me tell you, all this technology stuff that we do, you know, and I'm just as bad at it as everyone else, you know, on our phones mm-hmm. and, you know, we're not present when we're doing that. So it's not a good practice for being present.
I know it's really hard with all the distractions on our phone. And like, we have so many things that are trying to capture our attention, and it's hard to just like look up and slow down and not be thinking about what you have to do or what's next or how you're going to deal with whatever. When you wrote your book after your husband passed away, was that probably like the most vulnerable and raw thing you've ever, cause you basically, I would imagine, are opening these wounds that you're healing from, but it's also got to be a healing process to write about it and share about it.
Yeah. So there's two books that I've written on healing from heartbreak. One is where the Lifetime movie came in. They bought the rights to Heartbroken Open, a memoir through loss to self-discovery. I've since changed the subtitle. I've come out with it in paperback, which it's coming alive again after profound loss. But they're both true. The memoir came right out of my journal, which, so it was extremely raw, and it was the most vulnerable time in mine and my daughter's lives. Mm-hmm. But because of that, you know, I could never go back and write that book like that again, because it was so much a part of my own healing mm-hmm. that's why I think it has a profound effect on the people that read it, because they feel that sense of companionship, mm-hmm. like they're not alone, because some of the really hardest times in our lives are that way, because we feel very isolated and alone in our pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. So I really put that out there, because I also, there was so much being a young widow, being only 43 when my husband died. There were so many things that I was going through that I just didn't feel like the world spoke to at that time. Yeah. And this was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I feel like that was a very pioneering kind of book to write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always thought just people who are close to me who have lost loved ones, and that feeling of that instant feeling of feeling like everyone's there and showing up for you. They're there for, you know, a certain amount of time. And then it feels like all of a sudden everyone's lives continue, and it's not in a way that is trying to leave anyone behind or make you feel isolated, but everyone just moves on with their life, and you're stuck in this hole of like, I don't get to leave this feeling. And I think only people who have been through that can relate to that. And there's something really tragic and beautiful all at once about that feeling. But you writing about that, and people, even though you're 15 years removed from that initial feeling, what I've heard about grief and that loss is that the grief stays the same and time grows around it, but like the grief never shrinks, is what I've always been told. Like the feeling of that loss never shrinks, but like time grows around it. And I think it's really beautiful that you wrote something that people can relate to when they feel that sense of loneliness or isolation in such a horrible time. It's like a,
yeah, I mean, I like to think of grief as a different kind of feeling now. I mean, there's grief changes a lot over time, and because you do heal, mm-hmm. you know, grief comes. And I, you know, I'm not sure that that's been my total experience of grief. I mean, I think what happens is I'm much more easily triggered in my grief now than I ever would have been, because my body remembers what grief is. And like, I just recently lost one of my soul sisters, like the two of you, like we grew up together, and she died of cancer recently. And it was just, it's heartbreaking to me. And I've just noticed that that grief is a much more central located feeling for me now. I can touch on it, but I also can leave it too, because my whole understanding of what death is has completely changed through losing my husband. And because I do see that we really do heal from those losses, and to believe anything different is to hold ourselves back. Mm-hmm. That I don't really think that we're in grief forever, because grief and love are not the same things. Love, it brings us out into the world in a healed place, and grief takes us inward on the inward journey. And I just don't think we're meant to grieve forever. Of course, we experience our loss forever. We miss our loved one forever in this life. But then we learn how to continue that relationship with them and carry them forward in life. And I do a lot of work with widows and widowers, and I really encourage them to think of it that way. When I lost my husband, I lost the man who was everything to me.
Yeah.
He was every relationship. He was the most wonderful man. And I knew he was my person. So I also knew instinctively that I had to live for both of us, that there was so much more life left in me, and that I had to heal and I had to live for both of us. Mm-hmm. And then I would continue to carry on for him, but also with him. So,
yeah, that's,
it's like so hard for me, because I think, you know, sometimes when you, I mean, I've never had to experience anything like that. And I feel like when you go through a breakup, you, it almost feels like a loss, you know, because that person was so present in your life and then they're just gone, but they're not really gone, but they're gone from your life. So I can't even imagine the amount of pain. You know, sometimes I feel like after a breakup, you can't even pick yourself out of bed. And so I really commend what you do and what you've done, because I imagine it's probably hard to kind of, you know, kind of keep chipping away at that and talking about it and kind of like reliving that. And so, yeah.
When you talk about, you know, hope, you know, and encouragement, one of the things that I've realized is that it's really incredibly difficult to take advice or have hope with somebody who hasn't gone through what you've been through, you know? So as a person who has healed and who is living a very whole life again, and I'm out of heartbreak, I can hold that light out for other people, and I can show them, yes, it is possible. You can choose not just to survive your losses, but you can choose to really thrive, and really thrive in a very beautiful way, and return to having a truly beautiful life of joy. And, you know, this was always my hope. It took a long time. It wasn't an overnight process. It was many, many years before I started to really feel complete. And in fact, I wrote a book at the 10-year mark called From Heartbreak to Wholeness, The Hero's Journey to Joy, because that was when I started to feel like, okay, 10 years, I'm feeling very complete on this journey now.
Mm-hmm. When they came to you and they bought the rights for the movie, were you part of the process of casting, or what was your involvement with that?
You know, I would have been, yeah, I definitely was on the production team, but I didn't have a lot of say, like, you know, in casting, but they were picking just such great actresses. Yeah. I was like, whoa, I'm thrilled with any of these choices. And so when they told me Heather Locklear had signed, I was like, wow, really? That is so cool.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, that is so cool. I love Heather Locklear. And then I, you know, hadn't kept in touch, and I looked up some of the things that she's gone through over the last few years, and she's had a really rough go. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is perfect, you know, because she's in sobriety, and mm-hmm. she's celebrating sobriety, and she's come through the other side. And this was like her comeback to television was really apropos to the whole theme of the movie, which was super powerful.
Yeah, I love how things work out like that. Like, you know, when things are just meant to be, and it works, because it's your story, but you wanted someone who maybe has experienced some hardship of their own that could really, you know, dig into that character of playing you.
Yeah. And she came out, we had such a fun time, like talk about a soul sister connection. I mean, I went and picked her up at the airport. She came out, we hung out at my house. She spent the night. We had all these just funny, like it turned out her, one of her very closest friends from college, from UCLA. I went to Pepperdine. She went to UCLA. She's 2 years older than me. Her very best friend, you guys are not going to believe this. Her very best friend is a gal named Janie Sinclair. And my husband only talked about, well, really three other women his whole life. One was a very dear friend. One was his first love. Well, his second kind of love. And the very first girl he ever had a crush on was Janie Sinclair. and we found that out in our conversations together. And we were just blown away at how close, you know, the degree of separation really is, that that her closest friend in the whole world was my late husband's first crush. I mean, tell me you don't think my husband has something to do with taking Heather Locklear out.
He was like, I'm going to make my presence known in this.
No, so it was, that was a, we had all sorts of really fun synchronicities that really pointed to the whole idea that this movie was really meant to be, and it felt very divine.
I love that.
I do too. I feel like, do you have, so what does like a day look like for you? You know, like, do you have certain things that you do daily to help you stay rooted in gratitude? Or like, or are you a wake up and have coffee? Do you make your bed? I need to know all the things.
So, I mean, for years and years and years, you know, I've been in a routine of, I go to bed really early. Usually when it gets dark, I start really falling asleep. I get tired. I wake up when I wake up. I never wake up to an alarm ever. I wake up at around 4 to 5 a.m.
Wow.
I get up and I wake up very thankful. That is one thing I've noticed, is I'm in prayer a lot when I wake up, and I'm just like, I'm praying and I'm thanking God for everything. And then I wake up out of bed and I go make my coffee. I come back, I take a few sips so I don't fall back asleep, and I meditate. Now I meditate very quickly, because I used to meditate for long, long periods, and now I can tune in very, very quickly. So I meditate for about 5 minutes, and then I usually hit the ground running or hit the computer running. So I have a practice, and I definitely don't flip my phone right on in the morning. I think that's really bad for your brain. Mm-hmm. So I definitely wait a good 15, 20 minutes before I ever look at my phone. And then I just, you know, I usually just, I look at what is my calendar like today? What do I need to get done? My creative hours are in the early morning. That's what I'm going to do all my writing and my communicating, you know, is in the morning. So if I have a blog to write, or I'm working on a book, or I'm helping somebody else write something, or I'm writing a foreword, whatever I might be doing, I'll be doing that really early in the morning, because that's my creative window. And I get it done just super fast.
Wow. I feel like that you could, that feels very different from my schedule.
I was going to say, you and I are soul sisters. Yeah,
y'all really are soul sisters.
Yeah, except for the look at the phone. That's the first thing I
know.
I
got to do better. I need to do better about that. Cause I feel like I've heard so many people say it changes your whole day when you can wake up and have either meditate or pray and have a moment of gratitude before you get sucked into our screen.
Absolutely. No, it's really, they've actually done a lot of, there's a lot of science on it now. It's really bad for our brains to go right to our phones.
I know. So now I'm like, what I really should do is I should back up my wake up time. Like I should wake up earlier, because when I wake up, I hit the ground running with work. I don't even, it's not even, there's like not even a moment. I just look at my, you know what I mean? Like it just goes. So maybe what I should really do is I should wake up 45 minutes before I need to be awake for work.
Yeah.
I think if you create kind of a peaceful ritual,
maybe 20 minutes.
You know, 20 minutes. I think 20 minutes will do it.
Yeah. I think I can get that done
like
in 20 minutes.
45 feels girthy.
Do you have any books that you've read? Like, aside from your books that you've written, do you have any books that you've read that have like totally changed your life, that you like three books where someone's like, what's the most life-changing book you've ever read? Do you have any of those?
I do. So one of the books early on that really shaped so much of everything that I am and who what I believe was a book that was written in the 1920s called The Game of Life by Florence Scovel Shinn.
I think I've heard of that.
And there's she has a bunch of amazing books. Like when they came out with The Secret, I'm like, it's no secret. That was Florence's work. Like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no. So that book just completely altered my existence. And then I absolutely love the wisdom in Cahil Gibran's The Prophet. So Cahil Gibran just wrote this very poetic book of wisdom. And The Prophet is one of the most profound poetic wisdom books of any time. So that's one. And then I really love Pema Chodron, When Things Fall Apart. I love all of Pema's stuff. She's just a very wise teacher. You know, I really relate to everything that she says, and she's just a wonderful teacher. So yeah, those are kind of my go-tos. You know, I don't read as much now as I used to. And sometimes I want to read some heavy things like the Bhagavad Gita, you know, like I want to read some big things. That's on my list. So I don't know when I'll have time, but I'm going to try and figure that out.
I was going to say, when do you have time? It seems like you don't stop.
No, I do. You know, my day is pretty over by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Like I'm pretty done by 2 to 4 in the afternoon. I rarely ever will do much at that time. And I always move. Like the other thing is about my day is I work in the morning and then I always do a workout. So I'm always moving for at least an hour or an hour and a half workout, whether it's yoga or it's a boot camp class. I do this great boot camp class that's online, Cast Class Fitness. She's amazing. And it just kicks my butt in total gear for 45 minutes.
Yeah, you've really got your, what's your sign, by the way? When's your birthday?
My birthday is July 5th. Oh. So I'm a Cancer on the Vedic. I'm a quadruple Gemini though. So I have a lot of Gemini in my chart. Which doesn't really fit. The Cancer fits me more on that sense. I'm very consistent.
Gemini.
Geminis get a bad rap.
They do because they're very creative.
They are very creative. But yeah, Cancer, that's, you know, cut from the same cloth, girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
I could feel the vibes, the Cancer vibes from both of you.
Yeah. Like when the sun goes down, I am done. Like it's like, oh, the sun's down. All right. Time to go to bed.
When are your birthdays?
I'm July 18th.
Okay.
I'm October 30th.
October 30th. Yeah. Oh, my best friend was October 30th, and my father-in-law was July 18th.
Nice. Scorpio and Cancer are a good friend mix.
Yeah, they are. Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my best friends, he's a Scorpio too.
Yeah, I have a lot of Scorpio friends. Tanya's it helps me practice my like caring empathy side, compassion side.
Yeah. But a lot of times that's on the cusp like that, isn't it? What's the sign?
Libra,
because you have a lot of Libra in you too, I bet.
I do, actually. I sometimes connect more with like the Libra traits. I do have some Scorpio traits, but I definitely feel like I lean more towards Libra.
I think because my friend too, and I feel like there's the Vedic system and the Western system, but the Vedic system is a lot more ancient, and it takes into consideration the movement of the sun around the earth. So it changes the dates, you know, so in Western is a much younger form of astrology. So you can really trust the Vedic system to be very, very accurate.
Well, I'm going to look into that chart because maybe that'll help me figure out like who I really am.
Who I really am.
What sign I really identify with.
Yeah, human design is really cool too. If you've never looked into your human design, that's a really cool system.
Oh, I don't think I have. Is that a test online I can take? Give me my
results. You can like get a human design reading. If you know your birth time and place, that's all you need to
know. Starting to investigate my erotic blueprint.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that yet.
I've been watching Gwyneth Paltrow's show, Sex, Love, and Goop. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's like the five love languages. There's the same thing for like sexual arousal. So there's like sensual, erotic, I don't know all of them.
Oh.
This is new. I just started watching the show, but now I'm like very intrigued.
As you do with everything.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for hanging out with us and taking time to talk.
Yeah, thank you so
much. I'm so excited to read your books. I mean, you're a rock star. You just don't stop. And when the daylight is happening, you're creating, and we love that. So, thank you for scrubbing in and hanging out with us. I felt like we were talking to a friend.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You too, you ladies too. Thank you so much for having me on, and keep doing all the great work you're doing. I'll be watching.
All right. No, thanks, Christine.
Bye.
Right, we're back. I love her. Y'all have similar energy, you and Christine.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I need to learn from her, though.
Both cancers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like my middle name is like Tanya Sweat the Small Stuff, Brad. So, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you should read some of her books.
Yeah, maybe she can give me some seminars.
Okay, I think we have an email. And Mark, take it away.
All right, Becca, thank you very much. This is from Anonymous. She says, my best friend since ninth grade has been dating my husband's brother. Okay,
everybody. Wait, say it again.
Yeah, see, I was waiting to do that. My best friend since ninth grade has been dating my husband's brother.
Cute.
So we're together all the time. My issue is that she's been dressing a lot more revealingly in the last year and a half, and it's begun to make me feel uncomfortable when she's around my husband. My husband is a butt guy. And while I do work out and I love my body, my butt isn't huge, but my best friend has a big butt. Anytime I'm with her around my husband, she's wearing tight leggings and a sports bra. Anytime we're in bikinis, which is a lot, we live in Florida, she's in a thong. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but when it's around my husband, I feel uncomfortable. He's never given me a reason to be insecure, but am I naive to think he hasn't noticed or looked at her when she's in front of him like this all the time? And if he has, is that bad? Do other people feel this way? Should I say something? Is it just my insecurities? How should I go about this?
Wow. I think it's your insecurities. Because if it's not your best friend dressing that way, there's going to be 5 million other people dressing that way out in the real world. There are people walking around. I was walking around in a thong in Hawaii. My butt was hanging out. My butt was jiggling from here to Timbuktu.
And then you ran into a whole bunch of his friends and it was super awkward.
Right. But, you know, like I think there's access to, you know, and forever, whatever, like women can wear whatever they want, you know, but there's access to photos, videos. Like you can't. It's just everywhere. And so it's unfortunate that you're around them all the time. And it's your best friend. I'm sure it's like awkward, but I don't think there's any benefit in you saying anything to her or to him. Cause I definitely don't think he's looking at her that way, especially since it's his brother's wife. And
I don't think, are they dating?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Since it's your brother's
girlfriend,
same difference. I don't think he's looking at her that way. I think if you say something, it's just, she's not going to stop. What, do you have a different opinion?
Well, not so much a different opinion, but I will say this. He has most certainly noticed her butt in a bikini. There's no denying that he has looked at it, maybe thought like, that's a nice butt. But you said something very important that said, he's never given me a reason to be insecure.
Right.
And you are naive to think that he hasn't noticed, but I think the fact that he has probably noticed and has still never given you a reason to be insecure is a very telling statement that you've mentioned. So I don't think it does anything beneficial to mention it to her, to him, because you don't want either of them to feel uncomfortable. You don't want her to feel uncomfortable wearing something that she's comfortable in, that she's confident in, and you don't want him to feel like he has to keep his eyes above a certain level at all times.
Right.
So I think it's something, and I think we all struggle with, many best friends that are so hot. Like if I got insecure every time I thought about my significant other like looking at them or like admiring their beauty, I would lose my mind. So I think it's more of like you realizing that it's your own insecurity and working on that as opposed to asking them to fix something that is your insecurities that should be addressed and worked on just within. It's not even like you need to, we all struggle with that.
Like the weekend where Becca's ass was literally on Red Star's Instagram. Every time he opened it, it was just like Becca's butt.
Instagram
Becca's,
glitch.
Yeah. Becca's butt, Becca's butt, Becca's butt.
Yeah.
Well, you're both right. I agree 100%. I think that we need to delve into like, what are you afraid of here? Or what are you worried about? Are you worried that he's going to cheat on you with your best friend? I don't think you are, because I don't think he's going to, and I don't think you have any reason to believe that. Has he noticed her butt? Like Tanya and Becca said, yes, he definitely has noticed her butt. It's okay. It happens. You cannot shield him from the world. You cannot shield him from seeing other women's butts. You cannot shield him from even looking at them and enjoying them. That's going to happen. It's a whole world out there. It's okay for him to look at it and not just be like, as if it's his sister. He can look at it that way. There are nude scenes in movies. Like there's all kinds of these things, and he can enjoy them. He's not going to act on them. And that's okay. And so anything that goes on between his ears, you can't control that, and it's going to be fine. I don't know what's going on with her, that all of a sudden she's dressing half naked all the time. I don't know what's going on there, but I guess that's none of our business. I guess if she emails us, we can talk about that. But she sounds like she's got some issues going on or whatever. But I think everything's fine here, and I think you should calm down, because until he gives you reason to be suspicious or to not trust him, then I think everything is great.
Yeah. Maybe she just started feeling good about herself and felt confident enough to wear things like that in the recent year, and that's why she's, you know, more comfortable than she ever has been. But
I enjoy a legging and a sports bra.
Me too. I always wear. I mean, yeah.
And also, he loves you. He loves you exactly the way you are. Yeah. He doesn't love you, but he wishes your butt were bigger. He doesn't. I promise you. He loves you exactly as you are.
Correct.
And there's no need to be insecure. Women, we're always comparing, always playing the comparing game. You should never, ever do that, because he loves you.
It's true.
It's true. It's true. Hope that helps.
I think it did.
Would you like to wrap up this episode?
I'd love nothing more. Well, we will see you shortly. And then, you know what I would like to discuss, because I posted about this and I got some qualms. Ross being my favorite Friends character.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Is that controversial?
It was controversial in my DMs.
Really?
Yeah, really gathered quite some scuttle.
Really?
Yeah. So we can discuss that on our next episode.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Because okay, I don't think he'd make my top five.
There's only six.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think he's,
you can't argue his comedic timing.
I'm with you. I think Ross is one of the funniest characters. I don't know if he's my favorite character, but
subtly
he is
funny. He's not like,
he makes me laugh out loud more than I would say. I mean, he's definitely one of the ones that makes me laugh out loud the most.
Yeah, but there's this whole theory about Ross and that he's a gaslighter and he's like toxic to
that,
Yeah. So we can get into that.
Yeah.
May I preview tonight's Grey's Anatomy, since we're on a Thursday, on a rare Thursday, scrubbing in?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Because it's Thanksgiving. And while Meredith faces travel complications due to the weather, Nick steps in to help in more ways than one.
Is that Scott Speedman's character's name?
Uh-huh. Richard and Bailey seek out emergency surgeries, and Amelia and Link reconnect. That's the latest Grey's Anatomy episode.
Well, sounds good.
I don't want Amelia. I'm kind of done.
You like Amelia and the new doctor?
I'm not even saying that. I don't know what Amelia's going to be with the new doctor, but I just feel like the Link thing, we've gone through every option of them together and it hasn't seemed to work. So I think I'm just ready for one of them to move on.
Change.
Yeah.
Well, if they reconnect, it just means Link's going to get his heart broken once again.
That's what I'm saying. She does not want to marry him. Another teaser for next week. I want to talk. I saw this TikTok where this girl was basically saying, if you've been with your partner for longer than a year and they haven't proposed, then to get out of the relationship. And I thought it was such a fascinating opinion, because I don't agree, but I wanted to dive into that next week.
What's
as
the
well.
Theory?
Just saying, like, a lot of people are like, I knew from the moment I met the person, so there was no need to wait for a proposal or to propose or whatever. I just thought it was a lot of people had opinions in the comments. So
Nice. Send that over, Red Rover.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we'll see you on Monday.
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.